and welcome again to the International Intrigue audio newsletter. This is where we read you our two main stories from this week's newsletter. And contrary to popular feedback, it is not yet our podcast. That is coming up soon. This is just another way to consume the content that we're already producing. Now, I know you didn't think that we'd skip the old Suez Canal blocked by a ridiculously big ship debacle this week. So that's our first story, but we'll talk about how it might affect global trade. The second story we cover is part two of our Xinjiang series and how businesses can prepare for the way the world is changing. And if you'd like to skip straight to the Xinjiang story, fast forward to about the 6 minute mark. On to the first story.
The Suez Crisis 2.0, the Ever Given. If you're a ship, you'd probably want to steer clear of publicity. Apart from Boaty McBoatface, nearly every ship that's had its name in the spotlight has been on the rocks, literally. What about the famous ships of Golden Age of Exploration who went out to colonize... Oh, never mind. The Titanic, the Exxon Valdez, I could go on. The Ever Given is no exception. Breached between the banks of the Suez Canal for the past week, the 400-meter-long behemoth, about the height of the Empire State Building, blocked a crucial shipping route linking Asia and Europe and cost the world economy an estimated $59 billion. Though official sources say it's now been freed by the tides, Ever Given will be immortalized as a ship that gave us quality memes and a copycat truck blockade while short-circuiting the global supply chain. And in the article, you'll see two excellent memes, which pretty much sum up my feelings about the motivation available versus the writing that I need to do, which is the size of the Ever Given. The Suez Canal. The Ever Given had been en route from China to Europe when it got bogged. A relatively simple journey, planned to traverse the Suez Canal, a 193-kilometre artificial waterway in Egypt that carries about 12% of global trade. The Suez Canal is important because it's the most direct shipping route between Asia and Europe. Linking the Red and Mediterranean seas, it allows ships from Asia to reach Europe without circumnavigating Africa. This not only saves both dollars and time, but also protects ships from tempestuous weather and pesky pirates. How to block a major shipping artery in three simple steps. Admittedly, my eyes glazed over while reading about the bank effect and the hydrodynamics behind how the Ever Given got itself into this pickle, but I'll do my best to explain. Step 1. As it entered the Suez Canal on 23rd March, the Ever Given faced a dust storm and high winds. The stacked containers on its deck acted like sails, which foiled the ship's attempt to steady itself in the narrow canal. Step 2. The ship tried to course correct, but ended up basically pulling a sick Tokyo drift, except there was no way to drift but diagonally into the canal sandbanks at a good clip. Step 3. The resulting traffic jam resembled a carnage caused by an overambitious driver who, upon embarking on a 5-point turn, realizes their mistake 3 turns in. While this incident pales in comparison to Suez Canal's previous blockages, it's arguably been the costliest to the global economy. It left a backlog of 300-plus other ships stuck behind Ever Given, carrying commodities like oil, natural gas, retail goods, and livestock. Many ships simply cut their losses and sailed for Africa. Zoom out. A few key takeaways. While we've all had our laughs at this, there are also some serious geopolitical takeaways to consider. 1. The global supply chain is volatile and under a lot of pressure as we go nuts on Amazon, some of us aided by free government cash. Demand for retail goods has increased exponentially during the pandemic, but supply is struggling to keep up with our insatiable one-click consumer needs. If you're thinking about how important global shipping is, something has gone wrong. 2. Have we reached high tide on excessive globalization? Events like this push companies to think hard about reshoring supply chains. The ripple effects after this blockage will play out for weeks, particularly in manufacturing, which relies on just-in-time supply techniques to limit warehousing costs and boost profits. 3. Might climate change make these problems more frequent? As temperatures rise, conditions become more extreme, and ships carry increasingly heavier loads, it will become harder to predict and control the water levels of key shipping arteries. For example, drought conditions in Central America in 2016 prevented larger ships from traveling through the Panama Canal. 4. Shipping choke points around the world will continue to be hotspots. 55% of crucial goods such as food and fuel passes through a shipping choke point. These include the Bab el-Mandeb and Strait of Hormuz, both on the Horn of Africa, and the Malacca Strait in Southeast Asia, which carries over 40% of global trade. And finally, 5. Might countries build more strategic mega-projects to ease global trade? China's love of mega-infrastructure might convince it to restart its currently abandoned plans to build the Nicaragua Canal, which aim to connect the Atlantic and Pacific Oceans. This would help China diversify its own shipping routes and control a slice of global trade.
Xinjiang, the ultimate wedge issue. Part 2. Part 1 of our Xinjiang series provided context about what's actually going on. Since then, China has sanctioned UK and EU officials in response to US, UK, EU, and Canadian sanctions on Chinese officials. It's real mature stuff. The international response. How the world has reacted. And here we've included a map which highlights the countries that have condemned China over Xinjiang, which is largely led by America, Canada, Europe, and Australia, and the countries that have supported China over Xinjiang, which is largely Russia, the Middle Eastern countries, and some African countries. Two things stand out. One, the support for China from Islamic countries who've loudly decried abuses against Muslims elsewhere, and the silence from countries like Brazil, the Philippines, India, and South Korea. These countries have all criticized China for less, so we can assume China's exercising some considerable leverage in the background to keep them quiet. But of all these, Turkey's response might be the most noteworthy. There are close ethnic and cultural ties between Uyghurs and Turks, and many exiled Uyghurs currently live in Turkey. In 2009, and again in 2019, the Turkish government openly condemned the Xinjiang situation as a genocide. Instead of sanctioning Turkish officials, Beijing has made concerted diplomatic efforts to encourage Turkey to, if not support China on Xinjiang, stay quiet about it. And it's largely working, which is why we consider Turkey a neutral country. The corporate fallout. After we published last week, it all kicked off. H&M, Burberry, Adidas, and Nike released statements of concern about forced labor in Xinjiang. In response, some Chinese consumers, and we didn't say all Chinese consumers because it was a vocal but minority of Chinese consumers, unofficially led by the CCP, boycotted these companies, leading to some virtue signaling fails from public figures, and this. And we've got a tweet here which shows a video with that was sponsored by Adidas, but they have reversed the video, so it now looks like the kids in the video are sponsored by Sabiba, or Adidas backwards. It's an absurd effort at boycotting Adidas. Apple also cut ties with their supplier Ofilm Group over similar concerns several weeks ago, but it barely made the news. As Ben Thompson of Stratechery noted in a piece he published on Tuesday, Apple is a poster child for doing business in China. It's a massive employer, and its products are very popular in China. It will likely be one of the last companies targeted by the party. And a random aside here, I once had the very great privilege of escorting the famous Australian author Thomas Keneally around Shanghai. I'll never forget how he howled with laughter as we drove past a heaving Dunkin' Donuts franchise, and he observed that Mao must be rolling in his grave at how China has perfected American consumerism. So, even if it is a genocide, what's the point of saying so? To answer this question, we need to understand how CCP propaganda works. And I wrote separately about my experience of engaging with this kind of propaganda over the past 2 weeks in writing these articles. The main thrust of China's defense to most criticism is to stop interfering in China's internal affairs. And again, here's another tweet, which was tweeted by the ambassador to ASEAN, Chinese ambassador ASEAN, and it shows t-shirts, hoodies, and phone cases with the slogan, "Stop interfering in China's internal affairs." No matter how kitsch, the message is powerful. Why should anyone be able to tell us how to run our country? Is something you might hear Boris Johnson, Scott Morrison, or Angela Merkel say. And that's the whole point of international criminal law. The most heinous behavior by governments against their own people is the concern of the whole world. From the Holocaust and Srebrenica, and excuse my pronunciation, to the Khmer Rouge and Rwanda, we've learned that genocide can't simply be a domestic matter. So whenever a country or a corporation calls Xinjiang a genocide, it's not just hyperbole, It's an implicit rejection of the CCP's claim that wiping out an ethnic group is the sovereign right of every nation. The narrative wind is blowing in one direction. CCP propaganda will continue to create wiggle room for governments and corporations to have their cake and eat it too. The same wiggle room that for the past 5 years means we probably all own something made by forced labour in Xinjiang. Whether through political expediency or newfound clarity, liberal countries seemingly care about human rights again. Xinjiang will increasingly become a geopolitical litmus test to split the world roughly in two. Liberal countries will use labour standards, import bans, and the growing importance of ESG to isolate and punish those who turn a blind eye to human rights abuses. China will use their policy of economic self-reliance to ensure they don't need foreign investment. But unlike the USSR, China will still participate in the global economy, but woe betide any government or corporation doing business with China that fails to toe the party line. Actually, just check out these remarks from a CCP official who put it far more clearly than I ever could. And in case anyone thinks, oh, Xinjiang will just blow over, consider how you might respond to, say, pressure to boycott the 2022 Beijing Winter Olympics, or the nationalization of a financial institution in Hong Kong, or the big one, military conflict in Taiwan. Make no mistake, difficult issues like these are coming down the pike thick and fast, and they're not stopping anytime soon. The result? Every country, every corporation, sooner or later, will have to choose where they want to do business. In the Chinese ecosystem or the US-EU ecosystem. So what can business do to adapt? We're not telling anyone what side to choose, only that we think eventually everyone will have to choose. For those that choose the US-EU ecosystem, here are some suggestions for the future. 1. Take a longer view of the world. Accepting higher labor costs and rethinking short-term KPIs are hard choices in market economies. But not looking beyond next quarter's earnings will risk being prosecuted in the US-EU system or being boycotted in the Chinese one. 2. Invest in startups working on these kinds of problems. Transparent supply chains, distributed manufacturing, geopolitical data and analysis platforms, and any other company trying to provide better and faster information to executives. 3. Elevate the importance of public policy. Almost every company will need to incorporate geopolitical considerations into their business strategy. The lines between public and private will get blurrier, and those who can't confidently operate in this space will be left behind. And yep, I'm aware this reads as, give me a high-paying executive job, and I'm fine with it. 4. Consider corporate geopolitical values. Corporations will shape our lives over the next 50 years more than governments. Leaders should consider whether silence on geopolitical issues is compatible with their broader ESG strategy. There's a lot to make everyone uncomfortable about this future, because so much is uncertain. As a therapist might say, uncertainty is the only certainty, so just focus on what you can control. Of course, the rubber of morality meets the road of reality when a nuclear-armed superpower engages in genocide. Only China can change its policies on Xinjiang. All we can really control are our principles. And so there you have it, another week in the can. Thank you so much for joining us via our audio newsletter. We hope you enjoyed these two stories. If you'd like to give us feedback or reach out, you can go to the newsletter and respond directly to the email. Or you can tweet us at intintrigue, that's I-N-T intrigue on Twitter. Until next week.